Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, heading into Memorial Day weekend is a perfect time to continue our series, End of War, in which we're asking, is war inevitable, or can human beings ever abolish war altogether? Our guest today is Paul Chappell, a West Point graduate and Iraq war vet who achieved the rank of captain before he left active duty in 2009. He is now devoting his life to trying to abolish war. He currently has a job called Peace Leadership Director for the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, and he's written a book called Peaceful Revolution, How We Can Create the Future Needed for Humanity's Survival. Captain Chappell, I'm so honored you would do this with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, Brian.
Can you tell us some of your own story to begin? Where did you grow up and what made you want to go to West Point?
Yeah, I grew up in Alabama. My mother's Korean. My father's half white and half black. And part of the reason I went to West Point is my father, he was born in 1925 during the Great Depression under segregation. And when I was growing up, both my parents told me the only place in America where a black man has a fair chance is in the Army, because the Army had desegregated prior to civil rights. And that was the reality of how my father grew up in the South under segregation. That's how he felt about his own opportunity being limited. And when I told my mother I was getting out of the Army 3 years ago, she said, "Are you out of your mind?" She said, "No one's going to give you a job." She said, "It's bad enough you look Asian, but you're also part black." She said, "Who's going to give a job to a black man who looks Asian?" And I think that things have dramatically changed in our country. Having grown up in Alabama, being part black, looking Asian, things have changed dramatically in the 1980s when I grew up compared to the 1880s or 1815. And so I was able to witness how things that people thought would never change, such as attitudes toward race, attitudes toward racial marriage, even attitudes toward women. 200 years ago in America, women couldn't vote or own property. And so the idea that that much could change regarding race, women, et cetera, I realized, well, maybe attitudes can also change dramatically toward war as well.
So that was part of the confidence you had in leaving the military in 2009. Were you saying a minute ago that you decided to enter the military because you were raised to believe that that was the only place where a person with your background could get an equal shot?
That's what my parents told me, and my parents weren't telling me lies. They were telling me the truth as they had experienced it. Mm-hmm. And my father, growing up in his conditions, that was in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s in the South, black men didn't have much opportunity. And that was a part of why I went to West Point. Another part, a reason I went to West Point, though, was I believed in the paradigm of war. I believe that war is the best way to protect the American homeland. War is the best way to protect democracy, protect freedom. And war is the paradigm that keeps us safe, keeps our families safe, keeps our freedom safe, and keeps our democracy safe.
Did 9/11 help increase your belief in that? Are you one of the folks who enlisted after 9/11 because you believe that?
Well, I went to West Point in 1998, and then 9/11 happened my senior year.
Uh-huh.
And during that four-year time period, my attitude was gradually changing, and I think my attitude evolved additionally while I was in the Army until where it is today. And I think I'm still evolving as well, but I think that a lot of it happened while I was at West Point.
So did you have this idea that war could be abolished and that you wanted to work toward that even before you were enlisted, or did that come as a result of your time in Iraq, or for that matter at West Point?
Well, General MacArthur, he's probably the most influential person upon what West Point is today. And in many ways, General MacArthur was the father of West Point. And General MacArthur, he has many speeches where he says that war has to be abolished. He says, from a survival perspective, the human race, from a survival perspective, has to abolish war. And he says, not only would abolishing war allow humanity to survive, because in this era, war threatens human survival, but also, he says, civilization cannot evolve to the next level until war is abolished. Abolishing war, if human beings were to have a negative attitude toward war, it would completely change our spiritual values, and it would create the next advance in civilization. And so that was part of it. I think that there is this attitude at West Point that war should be the last resort and that war is far more destructive than Hollywood portrays it to be. And another thing, too, though, is I think that attitudes in America have changed dramatically toward war. And the evidence I can offer for that is the fact that there is no draft. And the reason there's no draft now is if the U.S. government instituted a draft and started pulling middle-class kids out of college to go fight in Afghanistan, I mean, we wouldn't be over there very much longer. If there had been a draft prior to the Iraq invasion, there would have been a much different national conversation. So attitudes in America have changed so dramatically toward war, and that is why there is no draft. Because if there was a draft and they were pulling kids out of Berkeley and Stanford and all these different colleges to go fight in the Middle East, we'd have a much different national conversation about what's going on over there.
Former Army Captain, Iraq War Vet Paul Chappell, author of Peaceful Revolution, How We Can Create the Future Needed for Humanity's Survival, part of our End of War series. And you write that ending war is not only attainable, it's attainable in this century. Now, after all of human history has included war of some kind, what makes you think so?
Well, the evidence I look at is I look primarily at military history. A lot of people try to argue. I mean, one important question I ask is I ask the most fundamental question we have to ask before we can understand whether war is inevitable or whether we can end war, we have to ask the question, are human beings naturally violent? Are we naturally violent or are we naturally inclined toward being peaceful? If we're naturally violent, it would be naive to assume that war could ever end. And there's a lot of people who write about this phenomenon, whether we're naturally violent or naturally peaceful. They look at chimpanzee behavior and other kinds of animal behavior and anthropology, and there are good insights that can be gleaned from that. But I think the most important thing you have to look at to determine whether we're naturally violent or peaceful, you have to look at human behavior. And the biggest body of evidence we have is military history, because military history, you have an overwhelming abundance of evidence from every culture, every time period, and you have the evidence of human beings being in very violent situations and how do they behave, how do they react. And so a couple of quick pieces of evidence I can offer is one piece of evidence I can offer for military history that human beings aren't naturally violent is war traumatizes the human brain. War is one of the most traumatizing things a human being can go through. So if we are naturally violent, why wouldn't people go to war and become more mentally healthy? Why do people go to war for long periods of time and have mental breakdowns and psychological trauma? And this is why the Army does combat rotations. This is why the Army rotates people in and out of combat, because the Army realized during World War II that if you just leave people over there, their minds fall apart after prolonged periods of time. So the Army has to send people there for a year, bring people back for a year of recovery. Another piece of evidence I can offer is the greatest problem of every army in world history is when a battle begins, how do you stop soldiers from running away? If you look at our fight or flight response, Our flight response is far more powerful than our fight response. Most people's natural reaction when you try to stab them with a sword or shoot them with a rifle is to run away as fast as they can, as far as they can. So every general had to contend with this problem, that when the battle begins, your army wants to retreat. How do you stop your army from retreating, and how do you make people run toward other people who want to disembowel them and cut their heads
off?
So
you're saying those are pieces of evidence that we're not biologically, evolutionarily programmed to fight. We're programmed to break down under the stress of war and to run away from it unless we're specifically trained not to.
Exactly. And something that every military in the East and West, every effective military has realized is there are ways to make people fight. And probably the most effective way to get people to fight is if you look at our fight or flight response. When someone's pointing a sword at you or is trying to shoot you, your instinct is to run. If I were to go out into the street and pull a sword on somebody or a knife or a gun, most people's reaction is to get away from me. But what effective armies learned in ancient Greece and in China, or all around the world, is when people's loved ones are in danger, they will fight to the death. And so imagine someone, you're walking on the street, someone's holding a knife toward you, your instinct is to run. Now imagine you're walking on the street and someone's holding a knife toward your child. Or imagine a pit bull's attacking your child. So that's why every army in history, every war in history has it's all about, according to the national leaders, about self-defense. And that's why armies have to have this band of brothers and camaraderie and love between soldiers. Because if you love your comrades, and if you're being told that these evil people are trying to come kill your family, now you're going to fight to the death because you want to protect your family, protect your comrades on the battlefield.
And so one of your most interesting ideas for me in your book is what you were just describing, taken, I guess, to an even larger conceptual level, that war comes not from humans' innate aggression, but from our innate affection and empathy for other people. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting paradox that organized warfare is possible because of love. Love between comrades, love between soldiers, love of family, love of country, love of freedom, love of ideals. If you look at war propaganda, the reason I think the evidence is so convincing is if you look at military history, you can look at different time periods and you can look at different cultures, and you can see the same phenomenon in every culture and every time period. So one piece of evidence I can offer is if you look at war propaganda works the same way in every culture and every time period. War propaganda always tells people they're fighting for their family, they're fighting for self-defense, they're fighting for freedom, they're fighting for ideals, they're fighting to protect their way of life, or they're fighting to liberate other people. If you look at every war, it's about self-defense, liberating people, fighting for ideals, fighting to protect your way of life. And there has never been a national leader in history. There's never been war propaganda in history where a national leader told his people they're fighting for money or gold or oil. So the wars are always about something noble, self-defense, protecting family, protecting freedom. And there's never been a national leader who said they're fighting for gold or money or oil. If you look at the Crusades were about territory and gold and power, but the rhetoric was it's about self-defense, protecting our way of life.
How about colonial expansion? I mean, I actually think one of the arguments in favor of the position that we could abolish war is that perhaps there's been an evolution away from it being acceptable for leaders in the past to say we're going to expand, we're going to war for glory or for riches, building the British Empire, take your pick. And now it's less acceptable to say that than it was in the past. Or do you think it just never was?
Well, if you look at colonial expansion, I can give you a few examples. If you look at Mao, when Mao invaded Tibet, Mao said that he was liberating the Tibetan people from the dictator known as the Dalai Lama. If you look at Alexander the Great, one of the first major conquerors after Cyrus the Great, after the Persian Empire, Alexander the Great saw himself as a great humanitarian. He talked about global humanity, and he's trying to liberate people. He's trying to bring people under this unified, peaceful civilization. He's trying to bring humanity into harmony. And if you look at the Persian Empire prior to him, they believed they were liberators. They were bringing people civilization. If you look at the colonial powers in Europe, if you look at all the rhetoric, even like John Stuart Mill's, they saw themselves as liberators, that the Indians and the Africans, they don't know how to live well. We got to give them Christianity and we have to give them civilization. Same thing with the Roman emperors. And if you look at the Iraq and Afghanistan invasion, we're liberating people. We have to give the women in Afghanistan education and democracy. And so if you look at all the colonial powers, they have this noble rhetoric. And a large reason for that is because it gets people to fight. If people believe they're fighting for something noble, for self-defense, for ideals, for protecting mm-hmm. their way of life, to spread civilization, they're more likely to fight.
Right. Again, to your core idea that we're not naturally inclined to fight, we have to be convinced to fight. My guest is retired Army Captain Paul Chappell. He was a West Point grad. He's an Iraq war vet, left the service in 2009, and is now devoting his life to trying to abolish war. He's the Peace Leadership Director for the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, and he has written a book called Peaceful Revolution, How We Can Create the Future Needed for Humanity's Survival. Paul Chappell is here as part of our End of War series here on The Brian Lehrer Show, and we can take some of your phone calls for him. I wonder if there are any more Iraq war vets or any other veterans of war who this is resonating with, some of his argument about what's needed to get people to fight, or anyone. What do you think of Paul Chappell's theories and his hope that we can, in fact, in this century, abolish war? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or you can post to our page at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll continue with Paul Chappell right after this. We'll be right back. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with the latest guest in our End of War series. Is war inevitable, or can humanity eventually abolish war? My current guest argues that humanity can. Paul Chappelle, West Point graduate, Iraq war vet, now with the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and author of the book Peaceful Revolution. And Captain Chappelle, before we get to our very full board of calls for you, if you see your life's mission now as to abolish war, how does that mean you spend your time? What do you do day to day toward the abolition of war?
Well, I think all human problems come from how people think: racism, sexism, oppression, injustice, slavery. I mean, all human problems come from how people think. If any American politician today were to say we should bring back slavery, bring back segregation, women shouldn't be able to vote and own property, people would look at him like he's insane. But 200 years ago, that's how most Americans thought, and that's how virtually every politician spoke. But attitudes have changed toward oppression of women, toward slavery, and that's why we have different social norms today. And I think we also have to solve the problem of war along with environmental destruction and nuclear weapons by changing how people think. All problems come from how people think, and all progress comes from changing how people think. And I think that many activists have kind of lost that path, where the purpose of activism, and especially peace activism, is to transform people's attitudes, to do more than preach to the choir and to persuade people and to win people's hearts and minds. If you look at King, Gandhi, and many nonviolent activists, they were able to transform how people think through persuasion and through productive dialogue.
Phil in Queens, you're on WNYC with Paul Chappelle. Hello.
Well, I feel honored for both this segment, and I thank you for your service, sir. I have two quick questions, and I could take the answer off the air. How do we end war when a good sixth or seventh of the world's population is continuously propagandized against other countries, other religions, and even modernity itself? And secondly, I do want to contest, you sort of threw it out there, that the Crusades were about money, when in fact recent scholarly works have proven that when Pope Urban called for the first Crusade in 1095, Islam had been on the march and had conquered so much of the known Western world at that time for 500 years, and it was completely a defensive war, and also most of the people who went to war were the wealthier, despite Peter the Hermit and some other poor people's crusades. Most of them were very wealthy. Most of them ruined their finances. They had to hock their estates and sell their estates to defend the faith.
And Phil, I'm gonna leave it there. And I don't know how much we want to defend, how much we want to debate the history of the Crusades, but Captain Chappelle, I think his first point and his larger point, he talked about a sixth of the world population. He's talking about Islam, and certainly not to disparage all Muslims at all, certainly not out of my mouth, but there are those few who would be bin Ladenists, or call them whatever you want. And it's one thing for you to go around the United States and try to convince people in our democracy to have a cultural shift away from war. It might be very different and much harder in some more closed societies or among religious extremists like the bin Ladenists, who may not be open to that kind of rational argument. So how do you respond on that level?
Well, yeah, that's a really good point. And when I talked about the Crusades, I was talking about both sides. I mean, the Muslim side, they had their propaganda as well. One thing I write about, I have some propaganda in my book from the Japanese perspective, with the way the Japanese dehumanized us. So both sides do this, and I'm not trying to say it was just the West. Both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes this evidence so convincing, is you see this propaganda in every culture, every time period throughout history. But in terms of how do we deal with the situation now, I think if you look at the Arab Spring, you have people in Egypt, people in Tunisia, people in Syria, all over trying to protest for democracy. I think that breaks the stereotype that people in the Middle East just naturally hate freedom, because there's so many protests. If you look at Libya and Syria, you have people dying trying to protest for democracy and freedom. If you look at Egypt and Tunisia, those are protests where we actually supported the dictatorships. And I think we have to keep in mind that we are allied with the most extremist Muslim government in the world. We are allied with Saudi Arabia, and we've been allied for 50, 60 years, and we haven't had a war with them, and they give us access, of course, to their oil revenue. And they are the most extremist Muslim government in the world, more extreme than the Taliban. And so I think that there's been misinformation that the government's been giving us about what's going on in the Middle East. A good example is in the 1950s, Iran had a democratic revolution, and they wanted to control their own oil revenue. And we overthrew the democratically elected government, and we put a dictator in the place. And so a person I recommend is of reading about this is Andrew Bacevich. He's a West Point graduate, Vietnam veteran, colonel in the Army. And he writes about how the U.S. government and American politicians in particular are giving the Americans inaccurate information about what's been really going on.
But the question was al-Qaeda. You're winding up indicting the American government.
Pardon?
The question was about al-Qaeda, and you're winding up indicting the American government.
Well, I think the question is about the resentment in the Middle East toward the United States. And Andrew Bacevich, he's written several books about this. Again, he's a West Point graduate, Vietnam veteran. He was a colonel in the Army. He writes about how the resentment is coming from U.S. foreign policy. And the evidence he offers is, for example, the fact that there was a democratic revolution in Iran where people wanted democracy, and we overthrew the government, put a dictator in place. There have been revolutions in Egypt, Tunisia, against governments we support. If you look at every government we support in the Middle East, they're all dictatorships. And this resentment, though, allows al-Qaeda to recruit people against the U.S. Because you have, because of these policies, you have poverty, you have oppression, you have lack of opportunity, you have these dictatorships oppressing these people in the Middle East. And that allows al-Qaeda and other extremists to recruit uneducated, impoverished people to go die for a noble cause. Okay. And you have this nationalism and other things going on.
Catherine in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Catherine.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I find it curious that the topic is war inevitable and are human beings violent? And it's curious to me that virtually every individual discussed and named in the conversation this morning is a man, and that most of the violence is perpetrated by men. So I guess, you know, when I'm listening to this, I feel a little resentful that I'm being kind of lumped into that group, and I really don't feel represented. Would kind of like to, see what you guys think about that.
Right. Well, my position, I'm also a guest on The Takeaway on Monday, Memorial Day, and you'll hear in a segment that we've already recorded, my own position, which is that the first thing we need to do to end war eventually is to educate girls worldwide and toward the equal power, toward an equal power future between men and women, because, who are the violent criminals in prison for run-of-the-mill? They're men.
Could I comment on that?
Sure.
I think what we really need to do is educate men, because not to get too far into the weeds here, but I think that the way men identify in terms of being masculine has a lot, particularly in the West, I think, has a lot to do with the concept of domination and submission.
Right.
And I think that's really innate to, how men are raised and to identify as, men. And so I think we have to liberate them from that very narrow spectrum in terms of, their identity and behavior.
I mean, I don't think it's just in the West, but I think that's my guest's point, is he's trying to change culture to educate men. So, Paul Chappell, since men are in power and men are the ones who've been waging all these wars, Paul Chappell, where would you enter this conversation?
Oh, those are really great points. I'm really glad you brought that up. Those are some really excellent points. I think we have to keep in mind that, if you look at Jesus, Buddha, Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, Albert Schweitzer, St. Francis, Tolstoy, there's plenty of men who are not violent and aggressive as a stereotype shows. And I've met a lot of women in the military who have a very strong fighting spirit and who can be very aggressive. And, they're very strong fighting spirit. If you look at Margaret Thatcher, Sarah Palin, if you look at a lot of women in politics, they have very pro-war attitudes. So I think the problem is actually more complex than just saying, well, men are violent, women are not violent, because I've met too many women in the military.
I'm not saying women are not violent. That's really not a fair description of what I'm saying. And despite what what your response has been, the fact remains unequivocally that it is, as Brian said, most of the criminals in jail, violent criminals, are men, and the people going to war are men. The people starting war are men. And what I'm saying is I don't know that men are naturally more violent than women, but it does have to do very much with how they're brought up and to, what it means to be masculine. Now, that may not be totally Western, Brian. I think you're probably correct about that. That could be much more universal. But you can name all mm-hmm. the wonderful men that you want and, aggressive women, but the fact remains that, the violence is overwhelmingly perpetrated by males.
Catherine, point taken, and we're going to move on to David in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. David, hello.
Yes, hi. I hope you all are doing well. I'm just wondering how you guess would reconcile his very good ideal, about beating swords into plowshares, but how would he reconcile that with something like World War II, stopping a monster like Hitler and the Nazis? Should we have had a flight response instead of a fight response to that?
Go ahead, Captain Chappelle.
Well, I want to respond to the last caller's comment.
Sure.
I wasn't trying to misinterpret what she was saying. I apologize if I misunderstood what she was saying. I thought she had very good points. I was trying to add on and say I think she's right. I think it is cultural conditioning. And the reason I was mentioning what I was is I think it is largely cultural conditioning. But I didn't mean to misinterpret what she was saying, and
okay.
I appreciate her comments. In regard to World War II, I think that's a situation where if you have someone like Hitler, it's like, okay, you have an infection in your body. It spreads to the entire body. You have to take drastic means at that point. I'm not saying that there hasn't ever been a war that was needed. I think if you look at the warring states period in China, if you look at ancient Greek history, there were very turbulent situations where there was international anarchy. And if you were living in Sparta or ancient Greece, someone was going to try to conquer you. Eventually, you had to have a strong military. I think World War II was a situation where we let Hitler get out of hand, and it got so bad that we had to take this drastic measure. But I think the 21st century is different. So I think that 21st century is a different era where we can use different methods now that would not have worked in the past. What Gandhi did would not have worked in the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire didn't have the kinds of systems in place that would have allowed Gandhi to be effective. But in the 21st century, we do have these new systems in place that can allow nonviolence to be more effective than warfare.
Iraq war vet Paul Chappelle, my guest in our End of War series. His new book, Peaceful Revolution, argues that human beings can abolish war by the end of the 21st century. Do you think the abolition of war needs to proceed on different tracks in the developing and the developed world? Here we have the military-industrial complex and the desire to protect our high-consumption lifestyle. You were referring to American power in some of these contexts before, and everyone loves to point out how the U.S. spends more on the military than the entire rest of the world combined. And so that's a major stream of discussion that we need to have. But then there is local war, non-superpower war. Rwanda maybe is a classic example, or the wars in Africa today, some of them, or the Balkan wars in Europe. Are these different kinds of tasks?
Well, they're very similar to war in many ways, because if you look at the propaganda from the people in charge, you have the same kind of propaganda: self-defense, protecting our way of life. Spreading ideals perhaps might be part of it. And if you look at another major aspect of all war propaganda is dehumanization. Every war in human history requires dehumanization, where you have to portray the other side as not human. And so you see the same phenomenon even in civil wars. Civil wars have very rampant dehumanization because the cultures are so similar, you have to portray the other side as morally inhuman, as being evil, being monsters, etc. But I think that there are conflicts going on in many parts of the world, but there are ways to solve these conflicts. I mean, some of the best evidence I can offer is the most violent place in human history was Europe. Europe was the bloodiest place on earth for 400 or 500 years. Far more bloody. Europe was far more bloody than Africa is today in terms of the frequency of war, in terms of how many centuries the wars were going on for, and in terms of how much of the wars were based on religious conflict. If you just look at the 400 or 500 years in Europe where you had constant warfare. But look at Europe today. Could you imagine a war in Western Europe? Could you imagine France and Germany going to war with each other today, or Germany going to war with Great Britain? It's not. It's possible, but it's very unlikely. So if Western Europe could become peaceful, I think any part of the world could become peaceful. Another example is China. If you look at the constant warfare during the Warring States period in China, and now look at China. I mean, China within itself isn't going to war. If you look at the U.S., it's very unlikely that the North is going to war with the South anytime soon. So I think you do have areas where there used to be a lot of warfare. The best example is Europe, because Europe had the most constant warfare of anywhere in the world, from the Romans up through the Middle Ages. And now look at Europe today. Could you imagine a war in Western Europe? It's very hard to imagine today.
Monique in Tarrytown, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling, Monique.
Monique. Five kids, four of which are
Monique,
boys.
Monique, I'm sorry, we lost the beginning of that. Could you start over?
Hi, I am the mom to five children, four of which are boys. And I can tell you that from the moment little boys go running around, every stick becomes a weapon. And the key is being a mom has been teaching them to be defenders and not to be aggressors. Because, you know, to think that everyone is going to have that level of peace is kind of very idealistic. But one of the important things is that if you have rules, are you there?
Mm-hmm. We're listening intently.
Again, if you have rules, then you can have the justice and the peace. And once you have the justice, so I'm just kind of maybe extrapolating, but human nature, there is that, but it's about channeling it and to understanding a sense of what the rules are and justice. And it's an old adage, but if you want peace, you have to fight for justice. And now the biggest challenge today is determining and defining what is justice and what is fairness. So those are my comments.
Thank you very much. And I'm so glad you brought that up toward the end of the segment, because before we run out of time, Captain DeChapelle, I want to reflect that you write in your book that the highest expression of conscience is moral fury.
Right.
And I wonder why you use that term. We have war stemming more from empathy than aggression, according to what you were describing earlier in the segment. And peace stemming more from fury, moral fury. So you want to talk about how those fit together?
Yeah, I can talk about that. That's a really good point. And the last caller had some really insightful points that I want to address as well. So where does this term moral fury come from? Human beings, I think all of the evidence shows that human beings evolved out of a very warlike environment. And I think people make the wrong assumption that, well, the warlike environment was human beings fighting other human beings. But there's a lot of anthropological evidence. There's a book called Beyond War by Douglas Fry where he talks about all the anthropological evidence. It wasn't human beings fighting other human beings. But what it was is human beings were being hunted by predators. If you look at the African plains, you have hyena, you have lion, you have leopards. And here you have human beings. We're slow. We can't climb trees quickly. We have no natural weapons, no claws, no fangs, no tusks. And here we are being hunted by these predators for hundreds of thousands of years. And how did we survive in those situations? Well, we're slow. We can't run away from predators. And imagine a pride of lions, and there's a tribe of 15 humans. The humans have a couple pregnant women, children, elderly. How did the humans survive? Well, when human beings' loved ones are threatened, we go berserk. If our loved ones are threatened, we go crazy. If someone tries to kill our family, we go crazy. And so imagine a pride of lions finding a tribe of 15 people. The people are going berserk, throwing rocks, waving spears, making a whole bunch of noise, yelling. It's a very dangerous prey now. And so that emotion I call fury. It's the emotion when your loved one is in danger. Imagine a pit bull attacking your loved one. With no military training, you'd probably grab a stick, grab a rock, go hit the pit bull over the head. Imagine someone attacking your child. You would attack the person out of this sense of protection. And moral fury is this same kind of emotion, but rather than being physical, it has more to do with your conscience. So it's where people see injustice, and it really, really bothers them. They feel this moral outrage. So think about the civil rights movement where you saw these protesters being attacked with police dogs and fire hoses, and people saw it on national television and said, this is really, really wrong, and this is just unjust. And same thing with many movements where they showed the injustice of what's going on. And that emotion can be invoked in many ways. For example, when we're going to war in Iraq, and you hear all the American media talking about how Saddam Hussein is a ruthless dictator, and he's so terrible to his people, and he's a tyrant. And we have this moral obligation to defeat this ruthless dictator. If you look at the same thing with the women in Afghanistan, look at how these women are being oppressed by the Taliban. Don't we have a moral obligation to help these women? So the propaganda is also able to tap into this instinct in portraying people as a tyrant, and we have to stop them with military force. And it's also very effective at protecting our loved ones and in making civil rights movements and other movements effective as well.
For Paul Chappell, every day is Memorial Day, as now that he's out of Iraq, he is devoting his life to the abolition of war. He is the Peace Leadership Director for the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, and his new book is Peaceful Revolution, How We Can Create the Future Needed for Humanity's Survival. So we thank our callers to this installment in our End of War series, David, Catherine, Phil, Monique, and we thank Captain Paul Chappell very much for a very thought-provoking and emotional pre-Memorial Day End of War segment. Captain Chappell, thank you so, so very much.
Oh, thank you very much. And I have a website, peacefulrevolution.com. If anyone has any more questions, I'd appreciate to hear from anybody. But thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And listeners, you can see our entire body of End of War material and take our End of War survey yourself at wnyc.org/endofwar. Coming up next, Lizzie Stark from the literary journal Fringe explains the world of LARPs, live-action role-playing games, an amalgam of improv, fantasy, and historical reenactments. And all LARPers will be encouraged to call in. Stay with us.